You're listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio. I'm Casey Gilman. The College Connection is a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. This forum provides an opportunity for listeners to engage with the researchers, intellectuals, poets, and authors active within our academic communities. Republican political commentator and strategist Anna Navarro was recently invited to speak at Smith College's Presidential Colloquium. Navarro shared why she's been a lifelong Republican and spoke on the political values which she feels have been challenged by the Trump administration. Her talk was given the night after MSNBC's Rachel Maddow spoke on similar themes as part of the series. This talk was recorded on January 24, 2017, in the John M. Green Hall at Smith College.
So good evening, guys. Good evening. It is so good to be in Smith College. I want to tell you, I went to an all-girls school. I am all in for girl power, particularly this week. I gave so much thought to what to tell you tonight, you know, and I know this may come as a shock to those of you that watch me on TV, but I was at a loss for words for about 10 seconds. And, I thought for a while, I almost like should just give up on speaking and we should just do a group hug and sing Kumbaya. Give each other coping mechanisms on how to survive the next 4 years. And if all that else fails, girls, eat Haagen-Dazs and watch Netflix. But I went ahead and prepared a speech anyhow. But I want to give you just a little caveat. I didn't think Donald Trump was going to run. I never thought Donald Trump could win the Republican primary. I never thought he could win the majority of the votes. Oh, well, wait. Actually, he didn't. Make that, I never thought he could win the Electoral College vote, even if it was with a little help from his friends. Comey, Putin, Wiener. Can you believe this damn election actually involved and may have been decided by a sex scandal not involving Bill Clinton? So anyways, I just want to congratulate you on inviting a speaker who has not gotten one damn thing right in 18 months. I want to get through prepared remarks as you guys have waited so long and get to question and answer. But I also want to warn you, brevity does not come naturally to Hispanics, particularly to Cuban Americans. Have you guys heard of Fidel Castro? Fortunately for you, I was born in Nicaragua. And like many other South Florida immigrants, I fled communism as a child. And it taught me early that elections matter, being engaged matters, being informed matters. It matters today more than ever. Ironically enough, back then in 1980, I also fled persecution from a Russian-backed revolution. And they say history doesn't repeat itself. Before I get started, I do want to tell you, though, I'm a commentator. I give my opinions and my thoughts. I'm not a journalist. In case you don't watch cable TV, or, I don't know, you've been living in the International Space Station for the last 18 months, that objective, neutral, fair, and balanced thing does not apply to me. And what I do ask is that you hold me to being frank, to being blunt, to being authentic, to being genuine, and to showing some actual human emotion. One of the questions I get asked the most these days is, why am I a Republican? Well, here's the thing. I was a Republican when Donald Trump was a Democrat. I was a Republican when Donald Trump was an independent. I have been a Republican since I was 8 years old, since before I knew what political parties were, since before I was a U.S. citizen, since before I was old enough to vote. My family fled communism. Ronald Reagan supported us in that struggle. That pretty much sealed the deal for me. If I decide not to be a Republican, I'm pretty sure I will be disowned by my father. He's come close. And I've stayed a Republican because I grew up in South Florida. I tell people, maybe if my family had decided to settle in California or somewhere else, it would be different. But I grew up with Republican leaders like Jeb Bush and Ileana Ross Layton and Lincoln Diaz-Balart. These are people who are inclusive, who have fought for all our interests. My Congresswoman, Ileana Ross Layton, is pro-immigration reform, pro-LGBTQ rights, pro-freedom, pro-everything. And she fights for all of us and is inclusive. So I am proud to be the constituent of my Republican Congresswoman and support her vehemently. I also stayed a Republican because I believe in the values of a strong national defense, of smaller government. And when I say smaller government, that even includes staying outside your bedroom. I believe in individual responsibility, in in fiscal responsibility. And I'm staying a Republican because, damn it, Donald Trump ain't gonna kick me out. I want to be part of building an inclusive party. I believe in the two-party system. Yeah, I know some of you want this third-party stuff, but I'm a little pissed at Jill Stein at the moment. I believe we'll be a better and stronger country if we have parties that are actually working to earn our vote, competing to court us, instead of parties that maybe one takes us for granted and another one does nothing but antagonize us, ignore us. To address, and I want two parties working together to address complex national issues. And this was a very weird campaign season for me. It was the first time in decades, since I can remember, I was not involved in any way with any campaign or candidate in the general election. Of course, in the primary, I supported Jeb Bush, then Chris Christie, then Marco Rubio, then John Kasich, then Ted Cruz, then John Kasich again, because he was the only thing left. Basically, I would have supported a cardboard cutout over Donald Trump. In fact, I'm not sure some of the people I supported weren't cardboard cutouts. Donald Trump launched his campaign on June 16, 2015. That day, he called Mexicans rapists and criminals. He said Mexico was not sending its best people. That first day, which is engraved in my memory, I knew that even if he became the nominee of my party, I would never, ever, nunca, jamás support Donald Trump. I am not Mexican, but I realized that for parts of the country, for some people in this country, he was talking about people who look like me, people who come from south of the border like me, people who sound like me. I gotta make an aside here. So, when I started doing TV, I didn't know I had an accent. And I was, married to the nicest Anglo guy from Idaho. And I'd get all these tweets from people. And the people who, liked me would tweet me about my sexy Latina accent. And the people who hated me would tweet me about my annoying Mexican accent. And I came home one day and I said, honey, do I have an accent? He's from Jerome, Idaho. He looked at me like, are you really asking this question? I said, I'm from Miami. Have you heard Emilio Estefan speak? We all sound like this. So throughout the campaign, it felt to me like Donald Trump had gone down a list of all the people and all the groups I care about or I'm a member of and checked the boxes off one by one. How can I offend Ana Navarro today? I really felt like he had, honed in on me. He went after John McCain and POWs. John McCain is my personal friend, my mentor. And maybe not for everybody, but for this chick, he is a national hero. John McCain hung by his thumbs and was savagely tortured for 5 years. During that time, Donald Trump got 5 deferments because of a foot spur. On a foot, he can't remember which one, but it might explain his necessity to put his foot in his mouth. He mimicked and mocked a disabled reporter. My brother, Daniel Navarro, is 52 years old. He's got the mental and motor skills of a 14-month-old boy. I grew up watching kids stare at him, giving him weird stares and mimic his movements. I'd never seen an adult do it. I'd never seen a 70-year-old man, much less one wanting to be the leader of the free world, stand there in front of cameras being viewed by millions of people, mocking a disabled person. That just crossed a line for me he can never step back from. He questioned a U.S.-born judge's ability to do his job, a U.S.-born judge's, because his parents happened to have been born in Mexico. That's all of us being questioned as professionals. And I don't just mean Hispanics. I mean all of us who are proud, country-loving Americans who were born somewhere else or whose parents were born somewhere else. By the way, includes his 4 kids. And when, in the midst of all of that, in the midst of that, Judge Curiel controversy, I got into a taxi, or an Uber, God, I love Uber, in Washington. And you know, in Washington, drivers have CNN on the radio or NPR or anything all the time. They are the best informed people in America. You can ask them anything that's going on at any moment, and they know everything. And I get into this taxi, and the driver, off so often, they recognize me, not by my face, but by my voice whenever I start speaking to them. It's that, you know, non-accent thing again. And I get into this cab, and the driver, you know, recognizes me, and he starts talking to me about this issue with the judge, with Judge Curiel, which was in the middle of the, it was, you know, it's in the news, hot and happening then. And he tells me that he tells me with tears in his eyes that he works 6 days a week, 12 to 15 hours a day, driving that taxi, has been doing it for years. He's got three U.S.-born children who are in college. And he says to me, are you telling me that in Donald Trump's America, my three kids, if they grow up to be professionals, somebody's going to question their ability to do their jobs well because their father happened to have been born in Ethiopia? And I told him, no, that's not America. That's not the America I know. And so I refuse to have my or your citizenship, my or your love of country, questioned by any other American. I refuse to have us divided by color and religion and class. I refuse to allow that to happen, even if the person doing the questioning happens to be the president of the United States. And I think all of us should refuse to have that occur. This is no time to turn the other cheek. But here's the reality check. Embrace yourselves for this, because it's so hard for me to say. Donald Trump is now the 45th president of the United States. I said it real fast. Look, I know some people question his legitimacy, and that's okay. After all, didn't Donald Trump spend the last 8 years questioning more than President Obama's legitimacy? He questioned his citizenship, his constitutional eligibility to be president. We live in a country where we can. We don't get put into jail because of that. But whether you think he won fair and square, whether you think he didn't win fair and square, the truth is, 5 days ago, he put his hand on Lincoln's Bible and took the presidential oath of office. I know this to be true because I was there amongst the smallest crowd of a recent swearing in. And I suspect a lot of us, a lot of you, like me, when I say, you know, sympathize when I say this election has put us in an uncomfortable position. What do you do when you deeply respect the office of the presidency of the United States, but you don't respect the man holding that office? It is a very difficult question, I think, for many Americans right now. It's not an easy question to answer. I've thought about it a lot for 2.5 restless, sleepless, alcohol binging months. And here's my answer. I have no intention to forget all the things this man did and said as a private person and as a candidate. I will not forget when he called Mexicans rapists. I will not forget when he called POWs losers. I will not forget Judge Curiel. I will not forget John McCain. I will not forget the 750,000 DACA kids or their parents who he's threatened to deport. I will fight for them with every breath in my body. I will not forget the attacks against the Khan family. I will not forget the mocking of the disabled reporter. I will not forget the Access Hollywood tapes. I will not forget any of it, and I will not forgive any of it. Now, there is plenty in Donald Trump's record as a man, as a fellow human being, and yes, I am assured he is one, to make up my mind as to what I think about him. I think he's despicable. I think Donald Trump is despicable. As a private citizen and as a candidate, he either engaged or enabled racism, division, bigotry, or misogyny. I have friends who know him well, and they would call me angrily, and they would assure me Donald Trump is none of those things, that he was just hamming it up for the crowds, playing it up on TV. And I said to them, well, you know what? If I wanted to vote for somebody that plays a sexist, racist bigot on TV, I would have written in Archie Bunker. What I don't know yet, none of us know yet, it's only been 5 days, is how Donald Trump will be as a president. We do know he's going to continue doling out wisdom, distractions, policy, and 140 characters at a time. Will he work across the aisle? We just don't know. But after all, he's been a Democrat, he's been an independent, he's been a Republican, he's been everything that there is in Congress. Will he make pragmatic deals? We don't know. We do know, because he's told us a lot and tried to sell us a lot of copies, he wrote The Art of the Deal. Will he be more inclusive as president than he was as a candidate? We don't know. I will tell you, so far, it's not looking too good. And whether we like him or not, whether we want to give him a chance or not, what option do we have? If we care about our country, if we care about our future, if we care about our safety, whether you believe in God or you don't, and I'm telling you guys, this is no time to be an atheist. Because we better all pray to some God that he is a good president. The cost of him being a bad president is really just too great. It could cost American lives. What if he misses, you know, on national security? What if something terrible happens because he's got a bad team around him, because he's too busy watching Saturday Night Live? What if he does those things? We have got to pray this guy actually rises up to the occasion and decides to be presidential sooner rather than later. So I was asked to give you the political landscape in Washington under President Trump. The answer is we don't know what it will be like. We don't know what he's going to be like as president. We don't know what Congress will do with him. We don't know what's going to happen. But here are some things we do know. We do know so far there is not one single Latino on his cabinet. This is the least diverse cabinet in recent history. The first one since Jimmy Carter. Probably half of you weren't even born without a single Latino. Think about that. Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama have all had Latinos on the cabinet. Donald Trump does not. Part of me is actually kind of proud to think that there wasn't one Latino willing to lend themselves to it. But part of me, you know, when I get past being petty, you know, and I get to be a responsible adult again, regain my senses, I think it's terrible that there's not one Latino in this cabinet. I guess, you know, the taco truck hating guy wasn't available. But it really bothers me, and it should bother all of us, because it's really important for there to be diverse voices bringing unique perspectives and experiences into a discussion, into a debate around that cabinet table. And you know what else? It's really important, and I know this may sound corny, it's really important for little girls and little boys to see people that look like them and sound like them in high spheres and knowing that they too can grow up to do that. And I don't want a token Latino. I don't want a token woman. I don't want a token African-American, but do not tell me that in the United States of America in 2017, there is not one qualified Latino, there are no more qualified African-Americans, more qualified women that can be part of that cabinet. He just didn't seek them out. We also do know Donald Trump is not a career politician. He does not have the sensitivity to diversity that many of us expect from elected officials. And how do I know he doesn't have sensitivity to diversity other than he didn't appoint any Latinos to his cabinet? Because you gotta be really insensitive to attack Martin Luther King's friend, ally, guardian of his legacy, John Lewis, on Martin Luther King's birthday. We do know President Trump is obsessed with numbers and being the best and biggest, huge at everything. It's madness. Trump World has spent the first 2 days of his administration fighting about the size of the inaugural crowds. After all, ladies, and that's after they've spent all these years telling us it's not the size that matters. For 2 days, they screamed at us not to believe our lying eyes. I was there in 2009, I was there in 2013, and I was there last Friday. If you don't acknowledge that the crowds were smaller, you're one of two things, either hypnotized or blind. Make that one of three things, hypnotized, blind, or work for Donald Trump. But the right answer for Trump World should have been, who the hell cares about the size of the crowd? Guess what? He swore in. He is president. Deal with it. Instead, they choose to argue over something that we can't be arguing about because in order to convince us that it's not true, they got to go full China on us. They got to start scrubbing the internet of pictures and images and putting, you know, little fake things on there. And for, what, the last 24 hours, he has been trying to convince us again that he lost the popular vote by 3 million votes because 3 to 5 million undocumented voters voted illegally. Well, that would be the single biggest scandal in U.S. election history. And he's now president. He has a Department of Justice, and that Department of Justice has an entire department devoted to voter fraud. So why doesn't he order these claims investigated and show some evidence? We know why. Because they're a lie. And we also do know President Trump is not ideological. On many issues, he's had more positions than the Kama Sutra. Yesterday, he pulled out of TPP. On trade, Democrats are going to like with him and agree with him more than Republicans. On some issues, he can range from being progressive to being conservative, like in 1 week. We do know he will bypass the media, not stick to strict facts, and tweet out his thoughts, or as Kellyanne Conway calls them, alternative facts, which makes sense because it feels like we're living in an alternative universe. I'm old enough to remember when alternative facts were called lies. We do know President Trump watches news obsessively and does not take any slight lightly. In life, most sane adults, and for those of you who are, you know, who are students and are young, one of my life advices is pick your battles. And I find that it's what most sane adults do. But what we've seen is for President Trump and President-elect Trump and Donald Trump, all of them put together, there is no battle too small or too stupid. He will punch down even if it's against a Broadway musical. And we do know Donald Trump is going to keep some of the promises he made during the campaign. Today, he defunded abortions, and yesterday he passed an executive order of defunding abortions, U.S.-funded abortions in foreign countries. He pulled out of TPP. All of those were things he promised during the campaign. He's going to actually keep some of those campaign promises. He's not going to keep others. We just don't know which is which yet, which is very scary to some folks whose lives depend on executive orders, like those DACA kids. He promised to drain the swamp, and then he appointed Washington fixtures like members of Congress and the entire RNC senior staff to his cabinet and the White House staff. And I know a lot of them. You know, they're very good people. They're very qualified professionals. I've known them as qualified professionals. Kellyanne Conway, Sean Spicer, Ryan Priebus, Katie Walsh. And my hope was that if he surrounded himself with seasoned operatives, they would help him be sane. Instead, he seems to be making them be insane. We do know that after 8 very contentious and antagonistic years with President Obama, Republicans in Congress are really excited about working with a Republican president, even if that president is Donald Trump, who many of them distanced themselves from during the campaign but are now hugging as tight as they can. And we do know President Trump does not have detailed policy proposals, and that excites Congress, too, because it means that the policy wonks in Congress see themselves as being able to craft policy, and that probably will be the case. Here's what else we know. We do know President Trump is going to have to deal with a country polarized like never before. He lost the popular vote by almost 3 million votes. He's coming into the White House with the lowest approval rating of any recent president, and as we saw this weekend, a hell of a lot of women are pissed off at him. So, how many men are in this audience? I bet you a lot of you are afraid of one pissed off woman. Now think about millions of them. And I was in D.C. this past weekend. It was surreal. It's the only word I can use. I went to the Women's March. I didn't go to the rally because I like to hear Madonna sing a lot better than I like to hear her lecture me. But the march was huge. It was fun. It was colorful. It was organic. It was girl power. More than 500,000 men, women, and children, mostly women, marched in the streets of Washington. And there was not one arrest. This is the right way to send a strong message, pussycats. But let's just think about how remarkable this weekend was. On Friday, hundreds of thousands of Americans took to the streets of Washington to celebrate the swearing-in of President Trump. And even if Donald Trump is not your cup of orange Kool-Aid, we should celebrate. We should celebrate we live in a country with over 240 years of democracy. We live in a country where the presidency has been handed down from one person to another 45 times, without bullets, without wars. That is something to celebrate. 24 hours after the inauguration, millions of Americans took to the streets all over the country, even all over the world, to send a message to President Trump. 90 miles from the shores of the state I live in Florida, there's a group called the Ladies in White. They stage weekly protests against the undemocratic regime in Cuba, and they're frequently harassed, blackballed, beaten, or even detained. That does not happen in the United States of America. We can protest, and when we feel that somebody is treading on our rights, we should protest. Saturday, as I saw those impressive images of at least 3 million women marching across the U.S., I couldn't help but think about those ladies in white. In this country, we have the right to vote, we have the right to democratically elect our leaders, and we have the right to protest those leaders. Washington, D.C. was full of people who went there to celebrate Trump and others who went there to protest Trump. So I get on this plane last Friday from Miami to D.C., or last Thursday, I guess, because I was doing TV coverage on the swearing-in on Friday. And the plane was, I knew this march was going to be big, and I told Anderson Cooper that night on TV because more than half my plane was full of women. I mean, and you know that look. That look of a pissed off woman on a mission. And then about a fourth of the plane were like red hat Trump supporters, you know, red hat wearing Trump supporters. And I think the rest of us were just there praying to God World War III didn't break out. I was really happy I was sitting bulkhead really close to the exit. And you would see people in D.C. this weekend wearing pink hats, sitting in bars and restaurants next to people dressed in tuxedos, heading off to the inaugural activities. And if you stop to think about it, that's remarkable. I'm happy. I really am happy that those who worked hard to elect Trump, and I have many friends who did, got the chance to celebrate their victory. I'm happy that those who want to make sure their voices are heard in this administration got to send a message through marching. I don't resent or dispute anybody's right to celebrate President Trump or anybody's right to protest against him. Really, it's called democracy. It is democracy in action. And I'm grateful for all those rights that living in a democracy afford us. I and so many people I love and friends come from countries where that's not the case. It reminded me that I should never, ever take those rights for granted, and I urge you to do the same. We cannot take our rights for granted. The march on Saturday also reminded me what regular citizens are capable of. That march was started by a mom in Hawaii who, you know, was really upset the night of the election and went on Facebook and posted, "I'm going to Washington to go march against President Trump on inaugural weekend." She woke up the next day and she had thousands of women saying, "I'm coming with you, girl." We cannot forget that. We cannot forget the power of one person, the power of many people together, the power of one voice, the power of our voice. If you don't like what the government is doing, whether it's at the local level, the state level, the federal level, the international level, act, organize, rise up, speak up. I promise you one thing, I will continue to use my voice to speak truth to power. And if we don't speak up for the 750,000 young people currently covered under DACA, studying and working towards their dreams, and who today stand here terrified about what the future will hold in a Trump administration, who will? If we don't tell the stories of immigrants persevering and defying challenges to contribute to this country and make us better and stronger, who will? If we don't raise our voices to beat back our opponents, who will? If we don't demand equal treatment and equal opportunity and equal pay and equal respect, who will? We can't roll over. We can't play dead. As tempting as it may sound, we can't hide under our beds sucking our thumbs after I dip mine in whiskey and eating ice cream, waiting for this to pass. That's just not how life works. It's not how politics work. Regular citizens can make a difference. And there is something I want to end with before moving on to questions. If you ask me what is the biggest problem in America today that we face as a nation, I'm not going to say climate change or crumbling bridges or even rising tides, which I should because I live in Miami. And you may disagree, but for me, our biggest problem that we face today is the political balkanization of America. We are such a polarized nation right now, and it's getting worse, not better. Today in America, if you want to live in a political silo, if you want to live in political isolation, you can. If all you want to do is read and listen to and watch and surround yourself with people who affirm your beliefs, you can. We have lost our ability to embrace diversity of thought. I'm sure not at Smith College. But outside these halls, we have lost our ability to respect differences, even when it's differences of opinion. This campaign season, like no other I can remember, has put a strain on personal, professional, and family relationships. Friendships, marriages have ended over this stupid election. I will tell you, I told the man I slept with, you vote for Trump? One of the greatest joys in my life is having friends that disagree with me and that are different from me and that share their different life experiences and perspectives with me. So I urge you, particularly the young people in this audience, go outside your comfort zone. Learn about and from people different than you. Today, more than ever, we remember those things that unite us as Americans. That ISIS terrorist, he's not going to ask you whether you're a progressive or a conservative. He just wants to shoot you. The lunatic domestic shooter who starts randomly shooting people at an airport baggage claim, he's not going to ask you for your party registration. He just wants to shoot you. So I urge you to exercise your rights as an American, your right to free speech and your right to vote and your right to protest. But I also urge you to remember that people who think dramatically differently than you do have exactly the same rights. And that, folks, that one little thing is the magic of the United States of America. As long as we don't forget that one little thing, that we have rights and we have every damn right to exercise them, but that so do the people we disagree with, as long as we don't forget that, we're going to be all right. Okay. You can. Who's asking me questions? Somebody is. You can ask me anything other than my weight. Unless you let me tell you an alternative fact.
Thanks, Anna. We're going to start with a retrospective question. What story did the media miss during the campaign?
Donald Trump. We did. I think we didn't take him. I think nobody took him seriously. Not his primary opponents. Not the media. I find that he's got an incredible instinct for the shifts going around in the base, in the Republican base, more than people who had been seasoned politicians. So I absolutely think that we missed the entire Donald Trump phenomenon happening in front of us. We laughed at it for a long, long time, and nobody's laughing now.
So if you go back to the 08 and 12 campaigns, there are these great sort of campaign biographies like Game Change and Double Down. If you were going to write the book about the 2016 presidential campaign, what would you call it?
Everything that comes to my mind is a cuss word, which I don't want to use. My mother's already not speaking to me over that other word. What would I call it? I'd call it surreal. I mean, the entire campaign felt from start to finish surreal. It is surreal to me that we elected a president. I can think of 20 things that Donald Trump said or did during this campaign that would have killed any other candidate, any other campaign. And he just kept going. So, you know, maybe the word is Teflon. I don't know. It's a good question. I'm going to think about it some more.
So while you're thinking about that, we have a
circus. How about circus? The circus.
A little bit of a gear-shifting question. Someone wanted to know, do you still eat nacatamales?
Not enough, because I'm not in Miami enough. I mean, I certainly don't know how to make them. I really don't know how to make them. I mean, this is a tamal, a Nicaraguan type tamal, which is delicious. This thing has like so many things inside it, and then you wrap it up in a leaf. I can't even wrap a Christmas gift, much less a tamal. So, but I eat them when I go back home. They're good after hangovers.
Someone wants
I can't believe you know how to pronounce that.
I took a best guess. Question, how can residents of this very blue state support Republicans who want to resist the Trump agenda?
Look, I think we're all in this together. And I think it's about giving Republicans a backbone right now and encouraging them when they're doing the right thing. So when you see a John McCain or a Lindsey Graham strongly, rigorously question an appointee to Secretary of State, I think we should applaud that. And there's so many ways today to make your applause, your comments known and felt. You've got social media. They really do listen to that. Sometimes when I go into a senator's office, there's young interns picking up the phone. People are calling in and giving comments, and they're actually taking note and, you know, checking off how many people are yays, how many people are pros, how many people are contras. So I think Republicans who want to stand up against Trump are going to need a lot of hand-holding, moral support, being told that they're doing the right thing. I think, for example, today, Paul Ryan, and it's not easy. It is not easy to confront a president of your own party. And I don't expect them to do it easily or readily, certainly not at this point. It is a honeymoon period. And they want to give him a chance. They want to work with him, and that's, you know, that makes sense. But today, for example, Paul Ryan came out and said, no, I don't believe 3 to 5 million undocumented people voted in the elections. I think that's false. And I think when Paul Ryan says that, instead of telling him, well, yeah, but you know what, you've got no backbone, you should say, good for you, good for standing up for the truth this time.
What are the issues that will be most challenging for congressional Republicans to find a unified approach with the president?
You know, I think the most challenging issue coming up for congressional Republicans, well, I think they're going to have a hard time on trade, but I think he's going to win that one. I think that on foreign policy, he's going to certainly meet some resistance from folks like a John McCain, like a Marco Rubio, like a Lindsey Graham, who are not buying into the kind of protectionist, isolationist thing that he wants to sell, and who actually do want to investigate what the hell Russia did in these elections and not just pretend that nothing happened. But I think the most complicated issue by far that's facing Republicans is Obamacare, because and I'm very worried about what's going to happen with that, because so many Democrats don't want to work with Republicans. And, you know, an issue like healthcare reform is so complicated that I think when it becomes one party driving it, it tends to miss so many other perspectives. Like we saw happen with the Democrats. There's a lot of things people like about Obamacare, but there's a lot of things that even Democrats will tell you are wrong with Obamacare. So this idea that Democrats don't want to work with Republicans on fixing it, when they know there's things wrong with it, it bothers me, because then that means the Republicans are going to say, well, we're going to do it. Okay, you're not going to come with us. We're going to do it all our own. And rarely do such complicated issues get fixed in a good manner when it's all one-sided. So So they're going to have to do it. And, you know, anybody who's got children knows that taking something away once you've given it to them is a lot harder than not giving giving it to them in the first place. So they're going to have to work really hard and be very smart and pragmatic and compassionate and humane about crafting a replacement.
A question from an international student who's wondering what they can do as a non-U.S. citizen to bring about change and what actions they can take.
You know, I think you should, if you're an international student, I think you should talk about what life is like abroad. I think one of the strongest assets we each have is our own story and our own voice. And I think it's important for people, as I said, to go beyond their comfort zone and go beyond their little personal boundaries and, you know, share your story. What's it like? How do people abroad view America? How do people abroad view our elections? How do people abroad view what's happening here now? And share what, you know, what drives things there. The world is becoming smaller and smaller every day. I marvel at, you know, I remember when I first came to the United States, you'd go to a supermarket and like the, you know, there was something in the, that was called the ethnic section. And it was like 2 feet wide. And it was, you know, taco shells and chi-chi salsa. Now, you know, the entire supermarket is an ethnic section. There's sushi being made fresh there. There's something called sriracha, which can tear the lining off your stomach, being sold everywhere. It's the world is becoming a smaller and smaller place. And so I think it is incumbent upon all of us to learn more about people who live in different places. And so if you're an international student, tell your story.
So as a Republican, how do you reconcile the party that we saw during the campaign with the sort of core values that you identify as Republican? Is there a way to rebrand the Republican message?
I'm having a really hard time with that because a lot of the values I grew up with as a Republican, you know, for the longest time I said Donald Trump was not a Republican, Donald Trump did not represent Republican values. That becomes a lot harder of an argument to make when Donald Trump gets elected president as a Republican. And so I'm having a hard time with that because I'm not letting go of my Republican values. I'm not going to let go of thinking. I mean, I'm so old. I remember when Republicans were enemies of a KGB thug who wanted to interfere in American policy. And, you know, I'm not going to let go of that. I'm not going to let go of the idea of family unity. I'm not going to let go of compassionate conservatism. I'm not going to let go of those things. So it's difficult. It's difficult because I grew up, you know, with Republican leaders like John McCain, like the Bushes, like Ronald Reagan, who genuinely believed in trying to build a bigger tent. I'm not going to tell you they succeeded, but they tried. And this politics of division is something that I just don't accept as a real Republican value. So I'm not yet reconciled to it. I'm working myself through it. I'm hoping it's temporary insanity.
Looking ahead to the future, who do you believe will be the next woman to run for president?
Guys, I like to drink too much, I like to cuss too much, and I really like my Italian sports car. And I wasn't born here, not that matters, as Ted Cruz has proven. You know, I think we're going to be looking more outside the box, right? We usually, when you ask that question, you think about people currently in politics. And certainly, you know, I think certainly you're going to see Elizabeth Warren toy with it, if not run. I think you're certainly going to, you know, keep your eye on Kamala Harris, because that woman's rising up. And she's very charismatic. She's very talented. I would say keep your eyes on people that may be from outside of politics. Somebody, you know, we saw in this season on the Republican side, Meg Whitman came out like a fire lady against Trump and just was, you know, a person of great conviction. So I think we might look in you know, in places like business and places, you know, in other places that are not the maybe university presidents to run for office. But on the, you know, I definitely think that Elizabeth Warren, I think, you know, we may get our first Native American running for president.
So regardless of who it is, what advice would you give to someone considering a run for
a woman
presidency or the public office? No, just in general.
Do not send emails.
Great. So as you...
And by the way, if you're... top staffer's husband has a compulsive sexting addiction, make sure she leaves him the first time. By the way, that's another life lesson, ladies. Very hard to change an addict, a sex addict, who's not addicted to you.
So... When you find yourself sort of exhausted and overwhelmed by the state of politics or the state of the world, but you don't feel like you're doing enough, what do you find that kind of helps with that feeling of burnout?
Okay, this is going to be totally counterintuitive, and it's like I'm only confessing it to 300 of my closest friends. I watch reality shows, and I'll tell you why. Because the people that come out in those reality shows are so screwed up that it grounds me, and it, you know, I mean, they're tearing each other's wigs off, they're calling each other horrible things, tables are getting turned over, it is so crazy that it reminds me that I'm normal and I gotta go do something. So that's one thing. And the other thing I do, and I really like doing, is I like coming to speak to students. I think that I get more out of it than they do out of me, because, you know, young people are so smart. But more than anything, they're not jaded. They're not cynical. I live in a very cynical, skeptical, jaded world of politics. And being with, you know, with young people who have that kind of idealism and enthusiasm and want to make a difference in the world and are not jaded, to me, it's like recharging batteries. After losing the McCain campaign, I went and stuck myself in Harvard for 6 months. I came out of there thinking I was smart.
So earlier in your remarks, you mentioned the phenomenon of the alternative fact. What does that imply for the First Amendment? And is there a threat to the press of the way that the Trump campaign has been responding right out of the box? And what are the potential sort of bipartisan or centrist solutions on that?
Well, there's two parts to your question, right? I think it's a threat to America. This stuff with fake news, you know, that there could actually be people who believe that there was a sex ring going on in a pizza shop in Washington, D.C. The basement of a pizza shop, of course, the pizza shop has no basement, is really scary. The fact that people can read and listen to absolute falsehoods and ridiculous conspiracy theories on both sides and believe they're true because they want to believe them, I just don't know how you fight with that. So I think that's a real problem. As far as the press, I think the press has got to learn how to stick together. If Donald Trump is going to come after Jim Acosta and refuse to take his question, and if my friend Sean Spice is going to come and tell Jim Acosta, if you ever ask questions that rigorously again, we're going to kick you out of an event. Well, I think the journalist sitting next to Jim should ask the same question, should ask Jim's question. And if Trump doesn't answer that one, the journalist sitting next to her should ask the same question. And if he doesn't want to answer the questions, then they should all get up and leave. Because I think nothing would kill Donald Trump more than sitting in front of an empty room and having nothing to ask.
So what do you think is going to happen with the revelation that the president won't be releasing his tax returns? Do you think that the Republicans will join the chorus to see those released? Do you think that issue is just going to sort of die down?
You know, today, I don't think it's going to die down. I think it's going to be a continuous drip, 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 the same way that I think the conflict of interest issue is going to be a continuous drip, drip, drip. And, you know, I think to myself, if we've learned anything in this last campaign is that, you know, crap you thought nobody had on you, somebody has out there. So the, you know, the likelihood that there's some, you know, as Donald Trump calls it, some, like, you know, 18-year-old 400-pound kid in somebody's basement hacking into wherever these things are, you know, so I suspect at some point something is going to come out. And I think it's not going to go away. Today I heard that people were planning a new march on April 15th, a release your taxes march. I'll be too busy at home filing an extension.
And so maybe it's the tax question or maybe it's something else, but if you had a sit down with the president, what would you want to ask him?
I think if I had a sit down with the president, what would I want to ask him? I would tell him, you know what, Donald, do me a favor, deport me, audit me, waterboard me, but God damn it, leave those DACA kids alone. Are we done? These are so much fun.
We can keep going. Maybe we can find some more questions. But in the meantime, I'd like to follow up on the DACA question a little bit. I'm going to ask you kind of a multi-part question about education policy. I'd love to know what you think about his nomination for Secretary of Education. I'd love to know. I'd love to know what you think about likely higher education policy, if you have any thoughts into that. And I would like to hear more about DACA. As you know, there's Senator Lindsey Graham is leading a bipartisan mm-hmm. bill forward. And if that bill were to move forward, it would remove DACA from President Trump's hands. So tell us what you're hearing about all this.
Well, about Betsy DeVos, I would say it's incredible what you can get away with when you're white and rich. I have a lot of friends who I think very highly of, who I respect tremendously, people like Jeb Bush, people like Mitt Romney, who know her, who've worked with her on education issues, and who tell me she's remarkable, she's spectacular. She didn't come across that way during the hearings. The only thing we have to judge her, the rest of us who don't know her, by are those hearings, and in those hearings, she looked like somebody had dropped her on her head as a baby. As a special needs sister, it bothered me tremendously that she had no idea about IDEA. I think you're going to see a very strong push on, you know, not higher education, but K through 12 on issues like voucher, like school choice. Those are huge issues for Republicans, and I think you're going to see that get implemented. I think that, Common Core is DOA. And as far as DACA, you know, I talk about it to every elected official that comes within a 300-foot radius of me. And I think, you know, I'm really nervous about it. I'm really nervous about it because there's no way of knowing what's going to happen. And because it is an executive order and it can be undone with one pen stroke, and because he promised to do that. So it makes me very nervous and it makes me very sad. It breaks my heart. I get stopped 3-4 times a week by DACA students, which is why I'm so obsessive about it right now. And they tell me their stories. I would tell two things I would tell your student body. I'm sure there's DACA kids here. Number one, anonymity is no longer an option. folks have your information, folks know who you are. And so since living in the shadows and anonymity is not an option, tell your stories, because they are spectacular stories of perseverance, of patriotism, of love for America, of people who want to make this a better country. So if you are a DACA student, tell your story, share it with the world, and go show that you are, you know, you're just a good person working towards a dream and working towards contributing, not taking. And I would also say that a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was, there was a town hall with Paul Ryan on CNN, and there was this, I don't know if any of you saw it, this woman who was covered by DACA, she got up and she told her story, and which was incredibly compelling, and she asked Paul Ryan, do you think I should be deported? Do you want me deported? And as she was asking the question, I know Paul Ryan very well, I could see in his eyes the empathy, and I could see the feeling and him thinking as a father, and you know, and I could just see where he was going. And he immediately, without vacillation, without hesitation, said, no, I don't want to see you get deported. And so I, you know, my hope is that this is one where we give Republicans in Congress a backbone if they're the ones that need to act. And maybe, you know, maybe what ends up happening is that if Donald Trump does take DACA away, if he does allow it to expire, maybe it is the, you know, that one thing that gets Congress to finally get off their butts, grow, you know, a spine and a heart and get something done once and for all.
Ana Navarro, thank you for sharing your reflections with us.
Thank you for waiting for me, guys. Thank you. I'm sorry to have been late.
That was political commentator and strategist Ana Navarro speaking at Smith College's Presidential Colloquium on January 24, 2017 in the John M. Green Hall. Special thanks to Stacy Schmeidel and the Office of College Relations at Smith College. Next week, we'll hear from Professor Franklin Otto, who spoke last November at UMass Amherst about Japanese internment during World War II.
Dangerous in the eyes of American government officials at the time, because we didn't know exactly who might be willing or able to assist potential Japanese invaders. The closest approximation they had was proximity to Japanese culture.
He discussed the U.S. government's attempt to repair relations with Japanese Americans through reparations in 1988 and the years of discrimination Japanese Americans have faced over the course of American history. The airing of this talk will mark a day of remembrance for Japanese Americans, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt authorized the deportation and incarceration of Japanese Americans with Executive Order 9066 on February 19th. You've been listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio, a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. You can find more College Connection online at nepr.net. Or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. For New England Public Radio, I'm Casey Gilman.